Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, a sneak peek of this week's How to Win an Election. As a brand new film, Civil War, comes to cinemas, we'll take a look at the films released in big election years. And on our big thing, what impact does it have on the families of politicians wrestling with political life? And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Loads to get through today. Lots of news both here and abroad. Donald Trump's been hosting David Cameron. The permatanned Globetrotter still aggrieved about being booted out of office prematurely and still trying to find a role on the world stage. Meeting the former US president. I'm sure they had plenty to talk about.
I happen to disagree with her about Donald Trump. I think his remarks are divisive, stupid and wrong. And I think if he came to visit our country, I think he'd unite us all against him.
So great, so great. Big story from Labour this morning. Splash, look at this, across the front of the Daily Mirror. We'll punish tax dodgers, says Rachel Reeves. An extraordinary attack on Angela Rayner.
This was for so-called tax efficiency.
No, actually, to be absolutely clear, her £1,500 capital gains tax bill would account for just 0.00003% of the £5 billion that Labour need to find. So probably wouldn't be enough anyway. On the front of City AM today, the boss of finance firm Aberdeen is hit back at people taking the mick out of the fact their rebrand took all of their vowels out of the name to spell Aberdeen. Rishi Sunak apparently considering a similar rebrand until someone pointed out his name would read Rish and Sunk. Reform UK leader Richard Tice has been facing questions about why so many of his candidates have posted racist things online.
For heaven's sake, you know, if you're going to have a glass on a Friday night, then don't use social media. It's not sensible.
Yeah, we've all done it. We've all done it. You have a glass of wine on Friday night and suddenly you become a massive racist. It's very easily done. And finally, lots of excitement about the new Amy Winehouse film with Marissa Abella, praise for her portrayal of the singer. But some of our biggest stars in Westminster have been giving their own rendition for years. He is now working pen secretary Mel Stride serenading Labour's Valerie Vaz.
So given that we do agree on so much, could I perhaps come forward with the words, the immortal words, of the late, great Amy Winehouse when she said, "Why don't you come on over, Valerie?"
Uncanny, Mel. It's uncanny. And better still, we're rewinding all the way back to 2018. This is someone, name ring, it vaguely rings a bell, someone from 2018 called Liz Truss.
And here we are, 10 years later, and we are seeing the positive signs of an economy that has recovered. as Amy Winehouse sang, we are now getting back to black. We are now getting back to black.
Whatever happened to Liz Truss, we'll just never know. Right, as it's a Tuesday, it's a how to win an election day. And on this week's episode, Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein discussing TV election debates. It was this week in 2010 that David Cameron, Gordon Brown and Nick Clegg first went up against each other. And they've been a fixture of elections ever since. On the episode of How to Win an Election this week, I asked the panel whether or not they thought a debate could, should, would happen this time round.
I mean, the answer's obviously no. And what we've seen in previous, more recent elections is terrible television of, I don't know, dozens of people from every party. And you know, and a difficult situations where you've got sort of Plaid Cymru trying to give an opinion about the whole of UK politics and policy when actually they're, you know, quite rightly only really care about Wales. And all of it's terrible, doesn't kind of give any insight. And I mean, I don't think the broadcasters should put it on, but they probably will. I think that a format that can work quite well is where you have the sort of the more intensive interview. I think in 2017, Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn did a sort of intensive sort of interview with a studio audience in sequence rather than as a head-to-head debate. I thought that actually drew out quite a lot of substance in a useful way.
What about you, Danny? What would you advise Rishi Sunak?
Well, I'll start with Keir Starmer. Don't under any circumstances allow the debate. If you absolutely have to, insist that Richard Tice is there. That probably will stop the debate, but if it did, it would create a real problem for Rishi Sunak. If you're Rishi Sunak, yes, ask for a debate every day. You never know whether an election result may coincide with the noise that's created. It probably won't change anything, but it might. If you do, oddly, I think there is a case, and I'd like to look at the data a bit more before being certain about this, that unusually, it might be better if you did a debate to aim at your base rather than aiming at flipping voters, because you probably won't flip voters, but you might enthuse your own support and get more of its turnout. But I, as I say, you need to do a solid bit of work to make sure that that instinct was right, because normally my instinct is go for middle voters and try and convert. But Davey, I don't think, will be involved in this equation, so I wouldn't know what advice to give him. Obviously, my advice to him would be, please, obviously he should desperately want to debate, but he won't be involved in it.
Peter, what would be your advice to Keir?
My advice to Keir is,
apart from lose weight, obviously,
is the opposite of Danny's. My advice to Keir Starmer is to be a statesman. Have the debate, organise it as far as you can, just with Rishi Sunak, not with Richard Tice, who will just be a sort of disruptor in the whole thing, and try and turn the thing into a proper debate. Like, you know, people presenting, you know, not just taking lumps out of each other, not just offering sound bites, not just sort of, you know, coming in with the sort of cracks, and you know, try and have a proper debate.
When has that ever happened, Peter?
The reason I say that is because I also think Keir Starmer should not be appealing just to his base. I think he should be appealing to voters who have not yet made up their mind, who could go either way, because they've got to be persuaded that he's a serious guy for serious times with serious worked out missions and policies, that he knows what he's doing, he's going to roll up his sleeves and get cracking the moment there. And that is the sort of impact that I would like to see come out of a debate.
And you can hear the full episode of How to Win an Election wherever you're listening to this. Just search for How to Win an Election, but not before you've finished listening to this episode. Now, we're off to the pictures. There is a new film in cinemas this week. It's called Civil War.
Citizens of America,
the so-called Western forces of Texas and California
have suffered a very great defeat at the hands of the United States military.
Mr. President, do you regret the use of airstrikes against American citizens?
I have to say, I haven't seen it. I've seen the trailer. It looks great. It's got Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Pyman's in it. Well, somebody who has seen it is Jonathan Dean, who executive editor for Culture at The Times. Now, Jonathan's on the line. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi there.
Now, you'd think in a presidential year, presidential election year, you've got a film coming about armed rebels bearing down on Washington, D.C. It all sounds like what might be a sort of lefty lovey's, you know, attack on Trump. But you've seen it and you've found it. It's not that at all.
It's not that at all. And I think, I think that's what everyone was expecting. Everyone expects Hollywood, especially the stars who are involved. Alex Garland, who we should point out is actually a Brit. He's a British writer responsible for Ex Machina and 28 Days Later. So it's a Brit eye of America, but still, he works within the Hollywood system. We would expect a liberal screed. We would expect something. And obviously, just by saying the plot, it evokes the insurrection of January the 6th. It's got all of that stuff. But even in that one premise of this war in America being started by the joint forces of Texas and California, clearly speaks to kind of how apolitical it is. California, very Democrat, if not the most heavily Democrat. Texas, obviously a Republican state. And the idea is, rather than having California teaming up with New York and certain bits of Chicago and sort of bringing in New England and invading the Deep South, what he does is he shows this war starting from the two most kind of like politically polarized states that you could possibly get. And I think, among many other things, more kind of like filmic, like I think the film looks fantastic. I think it's really interesting. There's some great action scenes. Just that very thing about making it apolitical and making it not a liberal screed is probably the most fascinating thing about it.
Does it work as a film?
Yeah, so what he does, is he doesn't really ever particularly explain how the war started. We're thrown straight into it. Kirsten Dunst plays a war photographer who, I think she was also a war photographer in the Middle East. She was used to kind of filming the atrocities and the general wars that happen out there. And then she comes back and she sees similar atrocities like bombs and obviously all the death happening. Like the opening scene is a bomb in New York. And so I think the way it works, and this is what I think he's done really well, nothing looks like it was filmed in a studio. They drive through sort of very different parts of America. They go to Maryland, they go to Charlotte, they go to Washington at the end. It all looks somehow, and maybe they just filmed at 5 a.m. before everyone woke up, but the sets look very real. It looks like a war has been raging in America. I don't know if many people saw The Last of Us, which was the...
The zombie thing.
Exactly. And obviously, this isn't zombies at all, but that created very well a sort of damaged America kind of post a big war or event. And it reminds me a bit of that. I think impressively, it does work. In a weird way, it feels like Apocalypse Now, when that stuff of Apocalypse Now, when you're going through the eyes of the journalists, that's what the film is. We're kind of... Kirsten Dunst and the other journalists in the film are observing the war. And so that's sort of how it brings you in. So, yeah, it's not political. And I think that's really interesting.
It is really interesting. Because actually, we were looking back through the history of this, and you go back to, you know, 1976, all the president's men, you know, charting the fall of Nixon and Watergate, right smack bang in that year where Gerald Ford's vice president was trying to move on from it all, and the Democrat Jimmy Carter running against him. So in the past, Hollywood has stuck itself into an election year. Let's bring in Peter Newman from New York University's Tisch School of Arts. Peter, why is... You'd think in the past we've thought of Hollywood being political. Why is Hollywood filmmakers stepping back from what is a huge political year in America?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to recognize that this really isn't a Hollywood film. It's an A24 film, which is basically the most successful and most respected brand of independent filmmaking in the United States. I can't even begin to think of a major Hollywood studio or mini major having made this movie. So let's take it from there.
Yes.
Independent film, and it's a highly respected independent filmmaker.
And is there a sense that Hollywood, then more generally, the film industry, is not getting involved in politics? That actually, because America is so polarized right now, and ultimately, if you're in the business of making films, you want to sell tickets, you want bums on seats, you want the streamers to pick it up, And so that's more about making straight down the middle movies right now.
Well, I think to take a step back, the entire filmmaking process in the United States is such a lengthy one, from the seeds of development to when a film is ready to be financed and shot and eventually marketed, could be anywhere from 18 months to 3 years. So I don't think, again, talking about the studios, the battleships are prepared to make any kind of 180-degree turns 3 years in advance. The feisty independents are a little bit more adventurous, but again, this was a, at the time, the most expensive film that A24 made, and it was a very risky gamble for them to get involved with it.
If you've got, I want to ask you both, actually, your favourite political films. Because it feels like we did this a couple of years ago. We did a sort of World Cup of political films. People sort of sent them in. They all felt like they were quite old. They weren't any that were bang up to date. Jonathan, your favourite political film?
I do actually remember really well, and sadly it's not particularly new, so I would think about this a bit more, but I really did like Bob Roberts, which was the Tim, I remember it really well, 1992 it came out, the Tim Robbins film, about the kind of this like wealthy folk singer who kind of came and, you know, sort of used populism and his music to sort of become president. And he was talking at the time about the Reagan era, so it was like a bit after that. But then obviously when Trump came to power, Tim Robbins did say Bob Roberts came true. But it's that sort of thing that I like. But I think like it's I like the ones that deal with it head on. We've had too long Hollywood or kind of, you know, like, I don't know, the other studios dealing with things in allegory, saying, oh, isn't this so much like the political time now? Isn't this so much like, it? Doesn't this evoke such and such? What I like about things like Bob Roberts, and also in fairness, things like Civil War, it feels ripped off the front pages. I think I want films to be more direct, like things like those two are.
Yeah. What about you, Peter?
I'm not usually a straight down the middle kind of person, but I think All the President's Men is a superlative film, yeah. And it has the ability to look back. The difficulty with something like Civil Wars, and I must confess I haven't seen the film yet, but from everything I hear is they're trying to look towards the future, which is a very difficult thing to maneuver.
Yeah.
But apparently they've made a very, very good film.
Peter Newman there from the University of New York and Jonathan Dean from The Times. And you can read Jonathan's piece online, of course, with your subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next, what's it like having an MP in your family?
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The big thing.
We've already said goodbye.
Now, regular listeners will recognise this as the theme tune for the exit interviews. Every week I'll be speaking to one of the dozens of MPs standing down at the upcoming general election. to find out why they're leaving. And one of the themes which has come out a lot has been the long hours, the travelling back and forth between Westminster and their constituencies, and the pressure of the job and the toll it takes on their family life. Husbands, wives, children, wider family, who don't really have a say in the impact that politics has on their lives. And in this week's Exit interview, Conservative MP Paul Scully told me he just found it was impossible to balance his professional and personal life. In fact, it was a factor in his divorce.
First of all, slightly depressingly, I got divorced halfway through. So it's so massive.
Because of the job?
Partly. If there is a... It doesn't cause it. I think if there is a chink of difference in your marriage or family life or whatever, politics has a habit of just blowing that open slightly. So that didn't help.
Because that night that you could have had a chat, actually, you were a thing, you were voting, you were... It takes you apart a lot.
And you have to be really focused at one thing, and that allows you to drift. So I just need to do this engagement. I just need to speak to that person. Maybe I just need to have another drink with that person, because so much of it is about networking and social and relationship building. It's not just because we're having fun and those kind of things. You do have to invest that time, but that comes at a cost if you don't get your balance right. Mm. I didn't get my balance right. And it's interesting you talk about being a London MP, because part of the problem is early doors, that a lot of people said, oh, well, at least you're a London MP, you get back home at night, which is true. But the problem is I got back to the back of my ex-wife's head, because I'd be often back after midnight. And so literally, I will see you in bed, that kind of stuff. So
in a way, almost
no
is worse than if you'd...
Yeah, because you can compartmentalise your time if you're away. But at this time, you're still expected. The constituents expect a lot of you because, you can get back on a Tuesday night, can't you? Whereas if you're in Yorkshire, no, I can only do Thursday or Sunday, or Monday morning, that kind of stuff.
That's Paul Scully, Conservative MP, talking about the impact that politics had on his life and his divorce. But he's not the only one who struggled to balance politics and family. Here is just some of what some of the other MPs on the Exit interviews have told me.
So I left my meeting in Number 10, went home to write my resignation letter, got a phone call from Tony Blair's office and said, because I hadn't done anything wrong, but Tony Blair's office saying, you shouldn't go, Margaret. So I said, all right, I'll give it another 24 hours, see if it settles down. And we were cooped up in my house and we'd run out of milk. So my daughter went out to get a pint of milk so we could make a cup of tea. And she came back and she said, Mum, there's only three of them out there, because we had the pack outside. Shall I offer them a cup of tea? So I said, okay, there's only three of them. Go and offer them a cup of tea. She went out, offered a cup of tea. Another 20 jumped out of the white van. So she scuttled back indoors.
It was a very late night vote and I appeared to have a new baby with me. And so I must have just been recently elected and had the baby a few months afterwards. And there was no provision at all for, missing votes or proxy voting or anything if you had a baby.
For me, I always wanted to be able to see my children every day. And that means that you've either got to spend a lot of time with them in the car driving backwards and forwards to a constituency, or you've got to arrange things so that you can come back and be in one place. And there's no perfect solution.
When I was elected in 2010, my daughter was was her seventh birthday when I was elected. And my son was 4 years old. And I missed a lot of their growing up. And that is something that I regret.
That is part of the reasons for me seeking to move on, which is, quite simply, I want to be at the nativity plays. I want to do the school run. Yeah. I think it's really important. I'm not prepared to kind of not be there, in those years of my kid's life.
I've got two young girls who mean the world to me. And obviously doing these jobs, it's hard to balance being a good dad and doing the job well. And obviously you have to prioritise this job because it's an important job and you're doing it on behalf of the whole country. So, not being there for them as much as any dad would like to be is a challenge. And there's particular moments where that you really feel that acutely because there's something very difficult going on that you just can't be there for them. And that's tough.
That was from our Exit interviews with the Labour MPs, Margaret Hodge and Harriet Harman. The Conservative MPs, Robin Walker, Henry Smith and Chloe Smith. As well as Rishi Sunak, he hasn't done an Exit interview, not yet. That was him speaking to the Story podcast recently. But in a moment, we're going to hear from some of the people on the other side, people who've had an MP in their family. And in fact, this was Carol Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher's daughter, of course, who gave me an idea recently of what it's like.
When I was a student, a law student, she was Secretary of State for Education. And this was definitely tricky because students on the whole don't like the holder of that job, and she was no exception. So my colleagues at London University were saying, OK, we're going off to demonstrate against your mum. Can you just remind us where her office is and this sort of thing? So I think that was splashdown, Matt.
Did you ever join the protests?
No, I didn't. And I didn't take a lot of student friends home because I didn't feel it was very fair for my mother around the Sunday lunch table in her own home to have to defend her own policies, if you see what I mean. I've always said if you've got a famous parent, Matt, it's not, you are not famous, it's second-hand fame, it's the parent who's famous. And if you've got a parent who's famous in politics as opposed to sport or telly or showbiz or tycoonery like Elon Musk, it's quite different in politics because everyone has a view. And they are inclined to tell you their view because they're your sort of blotting paper for voters' opinions. People say, Carol, I think your mum's doing a lousy job in Number 10. Bring back national service. And you have to listen to all of this, Matt. And you can't say, excuse me, take a long walk off a short plank, because whoever's telling you might decide to vote for someone else.
And yet you have no agency over doing anything about it. You just have to absorb it.
Yes.
And then nod politely and walk off. And what was it like growing up with your mum juggling? I mean, actually, even to have a working mum at all was quite unusual. To be a politician, juggling constituency and parliament and a family, how did she do with juggling all of that?
I think she did a brilliant job as a working mum. She didn't turn up a lot in the evening because votes are often at 10 o'clock. I think I look back and admire the way she juggled it. You're quite right, in those days, I think I was probably one of a handful of children with a working mum in my class at the time.
And did you enjoy the usual family things? Birthdays, holidays, Sunday lunch, Christmases, driving lessons, the things that your friends were doing? Or did you feel like you missed out on some of those normal family life?
I don't feel I missed out, but for instance, Saturday, which was probably a traditional family day, was not in the Thatcher household, because my mother was often in her constituency, because that's what you do as an MP. So Saturday, when everybody else was doing family outings, was not the same in the Thatcher household. But there were lots of other things we got to do. I remember my excitement at going to the opening of Parliament or a few things like that. So I've always said it swings and roundabouts.
Now, we're talking about what it's like if you have a politician in the family. After so many MPs have used the exit interviews we've been doing on the show with MPs who are standing down to talk about the impact it's had on their family members. Well, let's find out now a bit more what it's like for the family members of MPs. I'm joined by Elizabeth Hohen, a professor of modern history at the University of Leicester, who's researched life for the children of MPs. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Good to
have you with us. Liz, we've also got on the line Linda McDougall, who is married to the Labour MP, Austin Mitchell, who was an MP for nearly four decades. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
And in the studio, Jimmy McLaughlin, whose father, Patrick, was elected 3 months before he was born, was then an MP from 1986 to 2010. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi.
So, Elizabeth, first of all, set out, because your research goes all the way back to the 70s, so set out how you think the life of the relative of an MP has changed over time. We'll see then if that chimes with Linda and Jimmy's experience.
I did a big study for the British Academy and published it in sort of 2021, actually. What I would say is that children really up until the 1970s were largely protected by their political parents. But from the 1970s onwards, they were not. That's what the findings were. And importantly, we don't really know the impact of a life in politics until that child reaches adulthood, and then they start to form their own families. And that's when the stresses and strains of what they've had to live with then start to come out and make a real impact on them as a person. In other words, it's almost like they start to experience things in their own life, and it starts to hit default buttons in them about what they didn't like, what happened to them, changes they want to make, or, more importantly, a mental health legacy that they never really got to grips with. And that's when that starts to come out.
And when you talk about being protected up until the 70s and then that changing, do you mean that it's because politicians start using their children? You know, we've seen yes. party leaders, you know, whether it's on the steps of Number 10 or at the local fete or feeding them a burger to prove that BSE's fine or whatever it might be, sort of using their children to further their political fortunes.
Yes, a lot of children get turned into child actors. They're standing at the edge of a stage. They're brought on for kind of key moments. But you have to keep in mind that politicians themselves, and this is one of the things I find, I couldn't get politicians to talk to me about this. And the reason was it was the elephant in the room. They didn't want to admit that they themselves had used their children for publicity purposes. This was the thing, it was almost, I called it the last taboo in politics. They didn't want to talk about the degree to which this had happened. So, for example, most politicians today, when they exit, will do a book deal. The faster you do the book deal, the bigger the advance that you will get for it, and the more inclined you will be to become part of popular culture, celebrity, radio, television, whatever it is, however you're about to reinvent yourself. Now, the problem is that to humanize yourself, the publisher will say to you, well, we need a bit more family life in your book. We need a bit more photographs. We need you to add a little bit more in. Give us a little bit more of a flavor of you and the difficulties that there were. But from the point of view of a politician's child, who's maybe now an adult or a teenager, that's Groundhog Day. That's like revisiting everything that you did not want your parent to say. So now you're part of not just the political time in politics, but now you've entered celebrity culture. And in a social media era, that matters because publishers are looking for the soundbite. They're looking for, you know, the quick storyline, the human thing that happened that might appeal. But that's a child's life.
It's really interesting.
Part of the complication.
And I suppose we could all think of Ewan Blair, was it Junk in Piccadilly Circus, David Cameron leaving Nancy in a pub.
Yeah.
Does all that shine with your... Tell us about your experience then, Jimmy. So your dad was an MP for almost... from before you were born.
Yeah, exactly. So he was elected 3 months before I was born. So one of the questions you would often get is, what's it like having an MP for a dad? And I would often say, well, I don't know anything else, really. And then, of course, you're often asked, well, do you want to follow your kind of father's footsteps? And I think we always ask kids whether they want to kind of do their parents' jobs and so on. So I sort of see the point with, I think there's a difference between very high profile politicians, those that are sort of household names, and then my father, who was, you know, in the cabinet, but not really a household name. I think there's quite a clear kind of distinction with that. And I actually think it's changing slightly back again. I think the sort of moment with Ivan Cameron and so on, I think has led to politicians being a bit more private. But it is who they are. And we have had the Americanization of British politics, the more presidential style, the more focus on the backstory, and kids inevitably play a part.
Although it's interesting that we haven't, you know, Gordon Brown, we only saw his children when he left Downing Street.
Exactly.
David Cameron did have his children a lot in publicity things. That's not really been the case since. Boris Johnson, for various reasons, didn't use his children in publicity. Liz Truss didn't. We've got, you know, Rishi Sunak doesn't sort of parade them. Keir Starmer doesn't even name his children. So there does seem like there's been a bit of a shift.
I think that's true. I don't think David Cameron did it as much when he was Prime Minister. I think you're right, like, in opposition, when so much is around the kind of leader, that there was more of it. But I think that's that kind of moment where Ivan passed away. I think there's been a bit of a change since then of politicians perhaps, you know, wanting to be more kind of protective of children again.
And maybe that, as Elizabeth was saying, it's that sort of slightly chimes with the type as well, that, like, everyone oversharing actually, you know, slightly stepping back. Linda, what was your experience then? Basically, because your experience of being the wife of an MP covers the entire period we're talking about, from the 70s to, 5 years ago. So what was it like for you? Did you feel paraded?
Well, I've listened to some of this with amazement, because it's all very different from how it was in the 60s and 70s. I mean, how to explain? My husband didn't become a politician because... he was clever or smart or knew anything about politics. He became a politician because he was a television star. in 1977, when he worked for Yorkshire Television, and everybody in Yorkshire, you couldn't go in the street in Yorkshire without everybody knowing who he was. because those were the days of local television. People were absolutely fascinated. And the Labour Party was as a bit Rishi Sunak-like. Jim Callaghan was down in the dumps because everything was going wrong. The Foreign Secretary died. They had a by-election and they had to find a candidate who could win. Well, they didn't really believe he could win, but they would try. So Austin was chosen, not for, I mean, he was a Labour voter and he was a member of the Labour Party, but he was chosen because it was thought he could win. And the by-election was hilarious because everybody wanted to meet him. People came into the streets with bits of paper for him to sign. So it was a different world. And to cut a long story short, he won this famous by-election by 520 votes. Well, the person we haven't talked about so far is the wife, because in those days there were twofers. You got two for the price of one. Everyone expected the wife would play the same part as the husband did. And you need to look back at figures about politics then. Why, and also the number of people, I never worked for Austin, but the number of people who worked as partners with their husbands in offices in the House of Commons. And now that's all gone. I've just been reading this excellent new biography of Keir Starmer, and he spends a hell of a lot of time talking about how he loves his children more than anything. He has to protect them. All well and good. It's the politician themselves. But back in my day, 40 years ago, I was a television producer on World in Action at Granada in Manchester. And suddenly I had to pick up a whole new job as MP's wife. Well, I laughed when I heard those get home after midnight stories. My God, sometimes, you know, you didn't really ever get home at all. I don't know how we cope. I think things are actually much better now.
Do you, both Jimmy and Ed, did you find you changed your own behaviour? Jimmy, you were young, you know, your dad was on the shadow front bench and then the front bench. Because you being drunk on a night out, either in town or in London or whatever, that is a story, or you know, it was, in a way that your mates wasn't. Or if you get done for speeding, you are MP's son caught up to no good is more interesting than young man caught up to no good.
Yes, well, particularly the speeding when your father's transport secretary.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's exactly what I mean. Yeah.
There is,
if you were done for speeding, no one would care.
Yeah.
Apart from the fact your dad's transport secretary.
Of course. But I do think there's an element of, there are lots of children who have people in the sort of public eye or the local public eye. It was Theresa May was talking about recently, sort of being the vicar's daughter, you know, sort of always being slightly aware that people knew that, and you know, she had to
sort
kind
of on
be
show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think that's you know, part of the price that you pay for it inevitably.
What about you, Lyd? Did you ever think twice about doing something?
Oh, 14 times and fight with Austin about doing it. My life was a constant battle of trying to make the right sort of compromises, because I can remember ever so clearly having a cigarette ripped from my mouth by an enthusiastic Labour lady who said that I mustn't smoke in the street. As I mean, indeed, I don't think I've smoked for 30 or 40 years either, but at the time, everything was, the MP was, well, the one advantage I got, I obviously got an advantage out of it. A woman's status in the 60s and 70s very much came from what her husband did. So being the MP's wife was a kind of position in the community. And it would take someone even tougher than me to actually balk at doing that. So I was dragged to, people used to say to me at dinners, how lucky you are to be invited to our lovely dinner. We never get invited anywhere to have, free chicken on Grimsby Council or something. But 40 years of drinking the wonderful wine that was supplied by the borough of Great Grimsby when there were official guests. Yeah. I mean, who could say how lucky I was?
Linda, it's always good.
The only final thing I really would like to say, that I've now had a bit of, since Austin sadly died in 2021, I have thought a lot about, if life was like it is now, how I might have been Director General of the BBC. Done so much better. better, really.
And also, you're a great author as well, Linda. We've had you on before to talk about your book, so in your own right. So it's always good to have you on. Linda McDougall there. Jimmy McLaughlin, good to see you as well. And good to hear from Elizabeth Hohen. But as we were talking about, there has been changes to try over the years to make Parliament a bit more family-friendly. Under New Labour, they shortened the hours because... Linda was saying they often sat through the night quite routinely, trying to shorten the hours that MPs need to be in Parliament. But only on yesterday, I spoke to the Labour MP Stella Creasy, who's campaigned to improve life for MPs with new mothers. She told me that actually she thought things were going backwards and that Parliament had become less family friendly.
The evidence is very clear that mums are being excluded from our democratic process. I'm sure if you clip this, I'll get abuse online. We've got to change that. It's not going to change from one person. It's going to change from a group of people. And that's why I gave up on trying to persuade people in Parliament that it might be quite good if we actually did involve and engage mums and instead of wanted to support women from outside to come forward. And dads too, because there's lots of dads in Parliament who will tell you they don't have good relationships with their kids because they don't get to see them.
Well, let's hear now from Dame Margaret Beckett, who helped to introduce those new family-friendly hours and policies in Parliament when she was Leader of the Commons under Tony Blair. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you, first of all, on the point that Stella Creasy was making, do you think we've gone backwards? Is Parliament a family-friendly place, as you sort of set out to do, 20-odd years ago now?
It is, I think, infinitely more family-friendly than it was. I'm not sure we're going backwards. I think expectations have increased, and measured against increased expectations, we probably aren't delivering more.
It's interesting that point you make, because actually the thing that struck me speaking to some of the men who are standing down in the next election, they're talking about those, you know, missing out on children's sports days and parents even, all that sort of thing. And actually there probably has been a generational change. If you went back a couple of generations, dad wouldn't have been expected to be at the parents' evening, regardless whether he was an MP or running a business, whatever it might be.
Yes, I think that's right. And particularly with regard to, I mean, Stella has been campaigning very strongly about access for very small children, babies. And wants something that Parliament has not so far been able to deliver. So,
do you think, I mean, you've obviously been an MP for a very long time, Margaret Beckett. Do you think that you've made sacrifices in order to do that job? And is that just the case that, I mean, someone's already been in touch saying, well, look, I'm a nurse, you know, you work mad hours and you work Christmas days and all that sort of thing. It's not unique in that sense. Is it just the fact it's a very privileged thing that you are an MP, you're sitting in the Commons, you're voting on the laws of the land? There will be prices to pay with that. There's not a way of making it perfect.
That's right. I mean, what I always say to school children who ask about it is that it's not a job and it's not a profession. To be an MP, it's a way of life. And I think most people don't fully realise that when they're first elected. And although it's perfectly true that there are other occupations, like, as you say, nursing, when you are expected to work on social hours, on the other hand, you're not exposed, you're not in such a high profile position with people watching you and wanting to criticise every minute of the day. So it is a little bit different.
Is there anything that you think we could do? I mean, in a way, the changes that you made when you were Leader of the Commons were sort of concrete, you know, shifting the hours and trying to make it more family. Is there anything that you could think that we could do to go further?
I mean, not all of the changes about in the hours were made when I was leader. The thing that people perhaps tend to miss is that we didn't deliberately reduce the amount of hours that Parliament took. We changed the pattern of the hours. And although there's no doubt, I think, that it's more family friendly for people whose families are in London, MPs have always been divided among those who had their families in London and those who had their families in their constituencies. And I'm not sure how much more family-friendly it is for those who have their families in their constituencies. I know at least one parliamentary colleague who felt very strongly that it was not family-friendly at all.
Really fascinating conversation about the impact of having a politician in your family. If you want to listen back to some of those exit interviews in full, just search for the exit interviews wherever you listen to this. They're all available on Politics Without the Boring Bits. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.